Sharice, Avis, thanks for joining the program.
Thanks for having us.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Everybody staying safe?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, that's right. I'm not going anywhere without my mask.
Yeah, the question is safe.
No game.
Safe from what? That is... That is the question tonight. Before we even get into some of the things I've already mentioned, we've got to talk about this late-breaking story about the news and Bubba Wallace and NASCAR. I'm going to start with you, Sharice. The FBI says that the noose that was found in Bubba Wallace's garage has been there since October. He has only occupied that garage since last week. Hopefully, this is going to be all that there is, but even some conservatives are already coming out and saying this is like Jesse Smollett. What do you think?
Well, I just want to say, what do we expect of a Trump Department of Justice? I mean, AG Barr has shown us what a Trump administration looks like from a Justice Department standpoint, and so I don't expect, I mean, I had a very low expectation of the investigation to begin with, because what we have to recognize is that it was a secured area. So it was there's only so many people that had access to that area. And I don't know if you guys saw the display of drivers, you know, walking with him with the car. I mean, one of the people that probably hung the noose was probably in that crowd, right? And so the idea that we were going to get something out of the investigation, I think is folly for us to even believe that. But what I think is more important about this is the fact that it highlights why folks are protesting, why people are upset, because it's the same thing over and over and over again, right? We make a complaint, the complaint is made, it's going to be investigated, and then nothing comes from the system.
Avis, the FBI says that it actually wasn't a noose. The FBI is saying that it was a garage pull fashioned in the form of a loop.
Nooses are loops.
Mm-hmm.
The last I checked. And I have to ditto what my sister said over there. I'm telling you good and well that this Justice Department is not to be trusted. How many times do we have to catch them in lies? I mean, how many times do we have to catch them in lies? It has been a consistent pattern under Barr. And even before Jeff Sessions, but even most recently and most blatantly, I would argue, under Barr, lie after lie after lie after lie. And so I too, had very little hope of a genuine investigation when it went up the chain in terms of this administration. And I'm not surprised that they came back with findings that, to me, are quite suspect.
Okay, let's talk a little bit, or a lot, about Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the Trump campaign. President Trump, very, very disappointed at the hundreds of thousands, the millions and millions of people who were expected to attend his first rally since February, and the Oklahoma Fire Marshal said only 6,200 people showed up. There were empty seats. And, you know, that's the first issue. The second issue is that the president said that he asked, he told his coronavirus task force to slow down the testing. And then his staff says he was kidding. Today he says he wasn't kidding. Anthony Fauci on Capitol Hill and the head of the CDC said nobody told them to slow down the testing, and my head hurts already. Avis, help me make sense of this.
You know, I believe from the very beginning, and I've said this a gazillion times, that this administration intentionally slow walked the testing in order to artificially suppress the numbers. And as far as I'm concerned, what we saw in Tulsa was a moment of honesty out of Trump. I believe he did express that to someone. I don't know if it was Fauci, but I believe that he did express that to someone. And I believe that it was acted out accordingly. Because when the decision was made not to have any national coordination over testing, when the decision was made to basically have a chaotic system that was dropped down to the states where it was every state for himself competing against each other, and the rest of the world, quite frankly, if you remember, for supplies, it would present a situation where, of course, you would not be able to provide enough testing and enough of all the supplies actually that we needed, but especially in terms of testing. And when the very first decision was made not to even accept the test that was already developed from the World Health Organization, right, and instead try to come up with our own testing, which, as you might recall, quite out of the gate was an abject failure, and then they had to go back to the drawing board. All that time, people were getting sick and people were dying. And I, quite frankly, believe that people contracted the disease, died from the disease, before we even got our act together in terms of even starting testing. So I definitely believe that was one moment in which I can actually believe something that came out of Donald Trump's mouth.
Interesting. Charisse?
Yeah, so what I would like to say to piggyback off that is a few things. So the first thing is that I want to highlight the Obama administration at this moment, because what they understood was, and this is where I kind of get frustrated with people not understanding the structure of the government. Obama's team understood that a pandemic was going to move and shift faster than the federal government could. Right, the federal government is a large, ocean liner, and if it hits a glacier in the middle of the ocean, it can't move fast enough. So he created a team that could move fast enough to coordinate efforts inside of the White House. What does Trump do? He disbands that and says that it wasn't necessary, et cetera, et cetera. But the reason I want to highlight that is because they stepped them through what exactly would happen. So the Trump administration was more than enough prepared for what could happen in this scenario. And he, as Dr. Avis has said, has fumbled it mightily. So when it comes to this rally, what I truly believe is that we have to be careful to say that the fervor for him is dying. I don't believe that necessarily is the case, but I do believe that folks cannot risk their lives, because a lot of the folks in Oklahoma and a lot of these red states are essential workers or folks that have to go to work or are in states that are not doing much testing. And so they have to work. And so they can't, they can't put their livelihoods on the line to sit in his rally and rah-rah for 2.5 seconds and then have to deal with the fact that now they may be out of work and be out of a job. And so I think it's important to connect the dots there, that yes, I do believe that he's told the truth, and this whole thing is that they walk it back every time that he tells the truth, is that it was a joke. Every time he tells the truth, it was a joke, and now it's being walked back.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are at our political roundtable talking about some of the top political stories of the past week, and there have been some doozies. If you want to chime in, we certainly invite you to give us a call. Again, 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. So I think, Charisse, you make a really fascinating point that we may see, even among his most ardent supporters, a broad swipe of common sense, where the reality is that we all know someone who knows someone who is related to someone who has died as it relates to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we saw a surge right before the rally in Tulsa. The president is in Arizona. Arizona is also seeing a surge in positive coronavirus cases. And so even those people who may very well vote for him, as you suggested, may not want to risk coming out to see him and not social distance and seeing the possibility of community spread.
Absolutely. I've been watching social media a lot, right? And there's this gift that's out there, or a meme or whatever we call them now, of a scientist who showed the difference between wearing a mask and coughing on a petri dish versus not wearing the mask and coughing and what comes out, right? And I think that people understand understand what that means, right? That if I'm in a state or if I'm in a place that is not taking this social distance seriously, then I need to do it personally for myself so that I don't expose myself to coronavirus, especially in places where healthcare is not readily available, in places where healthcare is an issue, right? Oklahoma is considered a rural state. Arizona is a desert state, right? And so trying to find places to even be treated or to be tested could be problematic. So I do believe that played a culprit in his rally.
Indeed. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Piggybacking on the vote, we have some primaries today. Virginia, nothing really big happening there right now. I'm not, and don't misunderstand me. I'm not in any way, shape, or form, poo-pooing the vote in Virginia. But we really don't have a lot of hustle and bustle when it comes to contentious races, but the big issue that we are seeing right now is in Kentucky, where there are two Democrats, Amy McGrath and Charles Booker, white woman, black man, vying for the Democratic nomination so that they can challenge Mitch McConnell in November. And we also saw some issues a week or so ago in Georgia, where polling places in predominantly black communities were just really having some problems. Overall, Avis, talk to me a little bit about, the black votes and black politicians in the summer of 2020. Do they have momentum or are we, is this going to be another Hillary Clinton 2016 where the polls say one thing and the reality is another?
Well, if we're going to look, for example, specifically at that Kentucky race, that is going to have the outcome of that race, I think, will go a long way towards answering your question in that Amy came into this. I mean, I think most people just saw her as the automatic person that was going to run away with this. I think she's definitely received a lot of money from around the country. So she's been bombarded with cash. And she has been positioned by many of the sort of the traditionalists in the Democratic Party as the heir apparent in terms of taking on winning and going to the general election in the fall. But what we've seen is with the momentum of everything that's gone on with the Black Lives Matter movement, I really believe that the Booker campaign has caught momentum there. And I think this will be a good test for us to see if there is some transferability of the energy that we're seeing in the streets to actually energizing those folks to come out in mass for elections. It will be interesting to see if that sort of carries over, because polls are suggesting that those two are getting a little bit more close, and so it might be something very interesting to watch tonight. If there is an upset and he wins, I think that might really suggest that when November comes around, you're going to see a lot more not only black turnout, but probably younger black people voting. And just it will be a much more sort of activist constituency within the black community that we'll see at the polls. I think this is going to be a good test case for that.
Hmm. Interesting. Before I move forward on the second part of that, I do want to get a phone call in real quick. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Sheila, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Sheila. Quickly, what's on your mind?
Yes, I just wanted to say I just don't believe that the Bubba Watts, that was a pulled noose, and also I think it's strange that it came after he wanted the Confederate flag moved. I know as far as the coronavirus and Trump and the campaigning, this virus is deadly. And I can't seem to understand why people don't want to wear masks. Safety first. I don't go nowhere without my mask.
Mm.
And people need to get out and vote. My grandson is 18. He's been voting for the last 3 years.
Oh, okay. Well, good for him, and it's only the beginning.
That's
so,
right.
whatever his political position is, let's get him used to doing it and continuing to stay excited about the vote. Sheila, thank you so much. I appreciate your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Real quick, Charisse, before I go to a break, your thoughts about what was happening in Georgia, particularly in black communities in Atlanta during Georgia's primary voting. A little crazy down there.
Yeah, it's crazy. And the thing that's crazy is my sister just moved to this area. So she relocated to Rex, Georgia, which is just outside. It's actually in Clayton County. So I got to see it with my own two eyes. It wasn't something I had to go watch. I mean, I physically saw it. And so this, to me, is where we have to talk about the impact of the Shelby v. Holder case. Because a report came out today that talks about the number of polling places that have been closed since the Shelby v. Holder decision. And Georgia is number three in that list. Texas is number one at 750 closing of polling places, Arizona at 320, but Georgia is at 214. And so what I think is the undercurrent, and I think this adds on to the argument about what we're going to see in black politics, is I believe that we are now going to have a place. If we can get some more traction in the Senate election in November, that we can really get the Voting Rights Act off of life support, because it's already passed in the House for coming up with a new formula, and get it passed in the Senate, because that is what we need. We need an oversight board. We need to really put the teeth back into this, so that there's an oversight board that can say no. You guys are closing these polling places in areas that are going to be subject to blacks. For instance,
okay.
In Kentucky, they closed the polling places at 6, and there was 100 black folks outside waiting to vote. So
yeah.
I think that's the understory that we have to consider.
I need to take a quick break, but we want to remind you that you can hear this and every discussion via podcast on WHUR.com. The Daily Drum is posted before 9 p.m. every night. Also, I'm going to talk to Rashawn McDonald tonight on HUR at Home at 8:15. Join us on all of our social media platforms, Facebook, YouTube, and the rest. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm on WHUR is next. This conversation continues on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our political roundtable discussion as we look at some of the top stories of the week. My guests are political analyst Dr. Avis Jones-DeWeaver and Dr. Charisse Nelson, political analyst and diversity consultant. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Who would have thought that wearing a mask would evolve from a health issue to a political statement? It has become a red versus blue. Some people may say conservative versus progressive. Others may say black versus white. And like our last caller said, she doesn't go anywhere without her mask, don't know what her political leanings are. I will tell you that when it comes to masks, my political leanings are I want to stay alive. Avis, help me here.
This is so frustrating, because if we had any leadership in this country, this would not even be a point of contention. The reality is that if we all wore our masks, we would not be facing this huge uptick that we are seeing in many states across this nation, particularly red states, where governors have not only tied themselves to Trump and subjugated themselves to Trump, they're willing to risk the lives of their constituencies by mimicking his irresponsibility. It is dangerous. It is deadly. It is selfish. The science suggests that when you are wearing a mask, it really does little to protect you from someone who has COVID and is not wearing a mask. It's really most effective, it's really only effective, to tell you the truth, when everybody wears masks, because those people who have COVID and are going around without a mask, they have the ability to infect you even if you have one on. And so it's so frustrating to me to see this malignant narcissist in the White House who has made this all about him, made it into a political issue because he wants people to move forward with their lives, quote-unquote, as normal, such that the economy can be invigorated for him before the election, not caring about what happens to people in terms of the basics, in terms of life and death.
On this same topic, when you're talking about race, and I guess I'm still trying to figure this out, where you may have Black people who are from, you know, the same socioeconomic class as their white neighbors, same kind of, they may all be, you know, well educated, gainfully employed, but it just seems to me that, you know, just some white people just don't want to do it, and then you have Black people who do. Now, I'm not talking about those folks that are protesting the Black Lives Matter protests. I mean, it's a hodgepodge there. It's mixed. You got a lot of folks with masks, Black and white. But I think when you're just kind of talking about, the politics of Black folks versus white folks, the thinking just seems to be really, really different. Is there something in the DNA that I just don't know about?
Well, no, I think it's simple, right? You first asked the question, how did it become political? Well, I'm not surprised that it is political because when Chuck Grassley came inside of the chamber with a snowball to prove that, you know, there wasn't a real thing since climate change, I'm not surprised that we're seeing a denial of science. But what Black folks know is that the state kills us and thinks nothing of it. White folks are not used to that experience. There's a sense of entitlement. There's a sense of protection that they feel from the state that Black folks don't feel from the state. So Black folks understand, hey, I need to protect myself with whatever resources that I have. And at this point, I want to highlight that the Congressional Black Caucus was key in getting us racial numbers so that we can even understand that Black folks were dying at a higher percentage of COVID than white folks. So it's having the knowledge of numbers. It's understanding that the state doesn't really care about Black lives and our lives are expendable to some degree in a way that white folks don't feel that and haven't really had that experience over and over and over again in their lives.
One of the other things that continues to fascinate me, and we have seen more and more of it, we saw an attempt to take down the statue of Andrew Jackson at Lafayette Park in the shadow of the White House last night. General Pike's bronze statue, the only Confederate statue in the District of Columbia, was taken down last week and set on fire by Black Lives Matter protesters. And now we are seeing just a fascinating awakening, an historic awakening for America. And I want to stress that this is, you know, for America. All of a sudden, everybody, you know, nobody knew what Juneteenth was until they knew what Juneteenth was. And, you know, to be quite honest, yes, there are some Black folks who you know, didn't know what Juneteenth was. You know, shout out to my, you know, my parents who, you know, who were educated in HBCUs, and shout out, you know, because I went to one and my daughter went to one. So, but I knew about it even before I got to college. And then you have some, you know, some white people who are now you know, kind of understanding some of the really difficult history behind these statues and what happened in Tulsa in 1921. Avis, is this creating an historical civil war right now? Or are some people just really getting woke?
Well, this is a continuation, actually, of a battle that we've seen carry on for a little while now. I remember following the entire travesty over in Charlottesville. There was movements there then to take down lots of these monuments, and didn't really get very far. But now there seems to be more momentum, not just in terms of specific acts that are brought on by individual protesters, but also cities and states themselves. We have the state of Virginia that has already said that it's, you know, the state will be taking down and monuments in a way that will be more safe than having individuals out there trying to pull them down. And so we're seeing more momentum now, because I do believe that we are at a very unique inflection point in this country. I honestly can't remember a time in my lifetime where there has been such a focus specifically on this issue of institutional racism as it specifically pertains to Black people. Like, I would say that, you know, oftentimes, and I know Dr. Charisse can speak to this in great detail given her diversity background, but the way that we look at diversity in the modern era, in many respects, tends to focus on everybody but Black people. So it's very interesting to see this. It's very interesting to see that Black folk are at the center of our collective consciousness right now as a nation, and a lot of people are coming to reckoning with the evils and addressing those and facing those in very more honest ways than we have, period, in my lifetime. So I think we're making some movements. It's a long way to go, but I think that symbols matter, and I'm glad to see that some of these are finally getting taken down as they should have decades ago.
Charisse?
Yeah, so in the work that I do, the biggest thing that I come to the table with is getting folks to understand that they have implicit racial bias. Right. And that implicit racial bias is rooted in anti-Blackness, that your idea about what's right or what's wrong is rooted in the idea that Black is bad. Right. And you don't see it. And so that's why I believe that for the longest, us having the conversation of, oh, this dates back to slavery, or, oh, this is connected to slavery, it was easy for white folks at that time to say, oh, no, we've done all of this since slavery. It's no longer connected. But as Dr. Avis said, once you can show folks that there is structural racism, which is different from institutional racism, which is different from interpersonal racism, which is different than from internalized racism, then they're like, oh, okay, there's layers to this thing, right? And so that's why I think the moment is different now, is because we have overly focused in this country on the interpersonal relationship, right? The hanging of a noose, the using of derogatory terms. But we haven't dug deep to understand that institutions have been built on slave labor, and those practices have continued to proliferate to hurt Black people. For instance, I had a conversation just today about the insurance industry and how most insurance industries back into slavery because it was about insuring Black lives and about having them as property and insuring them. And so most people don't understand that. They don't understand how that there's all these different layers. And so what I really feel like what we're seeing right now is folks are being woken up to the layers, right? They can no longer say, well, it's not affecting me, because they can now see the layers in a way, because we are being diverse in our protests. And that's one thing I want to kind of surmise really quickly, is that we have to be careful with telling people how to protest, because protesting at different levels and protesting and causing awareness at different levels is getting folks in different spaces to wake up and say, okay, we have a real structural problem here, and it's not going to be solved in 2 months during a pandemic. 400 years is not going to be erased in two months during a global pandemic.
You know, one of the things that I think is so important right now when we discuss this, not only politically as we continue to see the demonstrations in the streets is that it is the reminder that even for black people, you are getting an education about yourself that you never got when you were in the public school system and in maybe even in some private school systems, you know, and the like. And this is why I say that. Two examples. I spoke to a friend of mine who is, as they say these days, she's black. She's blackety black in her thinking. But she also said to me that until the ruckus, you know, over the past week about Black Wall Street and the massacre of 1921, she did not know about it, and she was ashamed. And I said, there's no need for you to be ashamed. You were part of a public school system that did not teach that story. And just two Sundays ago, and this is a thing that was really fascinating to me, was that 60 Minutes did a story on the 1921 massacre of Black Wall Street and the destruction of Black Wall Street in Tulsa. And during that story, a young college-educated man stood up. He raised his hand when they were asked about it, this group of black folks who were asked about it in the church. And he said he grew up in Tulsa, and he said, that didn't happen. Nobody ever told me about that. And so even where it happened, there was no education about it. And we can talk about Tulsa, and we can talk about Andrew Jackson, and we can talk about 12 Years a Slave, and we can talk about the painful eye-opening, as I said, for America, but for black folks and white folks who may say, well, that was then, this is now. But the truth of the matter is, Avis, this is now.
It is. Definitely now. And the sad thing is that it's, as you mentioned, it's not surprising that for many people this is eye-opening. And unfortunately, even for many black people, they did not know about our own history. Because this nation has done a great job of erasing its history as it relates to its atrocities against black people, against Native Americans, against a lot of folk, right? But especially in terms of all the terroristic activities that have occurred over the centuries related to the black experience, it's been completely erased in terms of our institutions of education. I always knew before I had children that they would have their schoolwork to do, and they would have mama's schoolwork to do.
How about that?
Right. As it came to learning their own history, because I knew not to expect them to get it in the classroom. And we have to go that extra step as parents to ensure that our children learn their own history, because left to its own devices, this educational system is about indoctrination and not about education, particularly as it relates to our history.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to put a really fine point on it, you can look at some really great documentaries over the past 10, 15, 20, 25 years that, as we say, as we look at them now, could very well conspicuously omit certain facts about some of the historical figures in this country. You know, The Civil War by Ken Burns did mention that Robert E. Lee was a slaveholder. But I think the thing that is constantly missed that we're hearing now, and this goes to the where we are politically in this country, is that, you know, those people who, you know, fought on the side of the Confederacy were fighting against, you know, the ideal of the United States of America. And if the Confederacy had won, we would be living in a very, very different country.
Well, if the Confederacy would have won, we wouldn't be a country. So let me put that out there as a political scientist. And the reason is because they're in an agrarian society, and once cotton ran out and they weren't able to get their crops over the water to England or to Europe to manufacture fast enough, the country as they knew it in the South, the old Confederacy, would have fell apart. So let me put that out there first. But this is the opportunity that I use every time to plug historically Black colleges and universities.
Yes.
I'm only HBCU educated, right? I've attended three of them. At Howard, I always shout Howard out when I'm on this platform, because it normalizes Blackness. So this idea of having, like, Dr. Ava said, you know, she had mama homework. I had the same thing in my house. My father never stepped a day inside of a university unless it was to see me and my sister graduate. Yet he told me from the very beginning, they want you to not know who you are so they can tell you who you are. And so he was always passionate about us understanding who we were. And to make the point, I'm from California, and so I was sold on going to one of the state schools that has the best public education system for higher ed in the country, right? And he was adamant about me not doing it, so much so that he sent me, now that I'm older, I understand, pulled money that he didn't have and sent me to an HBCU tour that literally changed my life. Because then at that point that I understood that Black academics were normal. They weren't something of my imagination or a figment of my imagination, which is why in these moments when you talked about history, it's important to have Black scholars. It's important to have Dr. Avis who writes a book. It's important to have Dr. Nelson who writes a book, because we are the ones that are going to say, wait a minute, why are you telling this history? This is the other thing that you're not saying. And that is why HBCUs are important, and that's why Black scholarship is important, because it often rights the historical wrongs that are written down and that it continues to indoctrinate our children.
What were the other two schools?
So I went to Howard for my PhD. I went to the University of the District of Columbia for my master's. And I went to Stillman College in Tuscaloosa, Alabama for my bachelor's degree.
All right.
And I will be starting a professorship at Southern University in the fall.
All right. So you're black, giddy black.
I'm blackity black.
well, there you go. Certainly, we as always on this program, we are always saluting Blackness, and you deserve at least three salutes. On a more serious note, I do have some breaking news that I do need to share with you. This just kind of coming through. The Louisville Police Department has fired Brett Hankinson for his role in the shooting death of Breonna Taylor. That just coming down just a few minutes ago. Again, Brett Hankinson, the police officer who was part of the no-knock warrant where Breonna Taylor was killed back in March in Louisville, and where her boyfriend was jailed and still remains behind bars for that horrible incident in Louisville. So we're going to continue to keep you posted on that. I'm going to lose you, Avis, a little earlier. But on that point, let's talk about the issue with the police. I'll let you have a minute or two just to kind of talk about what is happening. We've got the situation in Louisville. We have the situation in Atlanta, and we are still now seeing this new battle brewing between police unions and the allegations of police brutality, and of course the deadly encounters with Black men and more broadly Black people with the police. What do you think? What are your thoughts?
Oh my goodness. So much to say, so little time. All I can say is, first of all, police unions, starting from the end there, they are a huge part of the problem. They are at the root of the rot that is the culture of policing that disregards Black life and then protects one another when an officer kills wrongly. They are not part of the solution. They're part of the problem. And just as there needs to be legislation across the country to, move in the direction that will be that will reform policing, something has to be done about these unions. They are just ridiculous. They are ridiculous institutions in terms of the lengths to which they will go, including, I would say, coordinating sort of walkouts, sick outs, coordinating activities among police departments that, in fact, they just do not work as a way of protesting when they are held in any way accountable for ending black life. And secondly, I would also say, just in terms of the murder of Breonna, it only took them, 90 days? We're almost,
right.
It's over 3 months that it took just to have him fired, and we're not even talking about an arrest yet.
Right.
The fact that this woman was murdered in her bed in the middle of the night as a result of a no-knock warrant with policemen who were plainclothes policemen, they, under any person's interpretation of that situation, you would be thinking that you're being, attacked by intruders in your home, because guess what? They were attacked by intruders in their homes who just happened to have badges. And so I am angry that it took this long, but I'm also angry that it's not far enough, and I'm not confident that we'll ever see the justice in her case that she deserves.
Yeah, this is looking like a real slow walk. I've no doubt about that. I'm sure we'll get more details on that tomorrow. Avis, thank you so much for sharing with us. I know you've got to go. Charisse, if you can give me a few more minutes, I'll let you wrap up. But again, Avis, good to talk to you. Thanks for being a part of this program. As always, please stay safe from the coronavirus. Stay safe from violence in the streets, and continue to do what you're doing to uplift our community. So, Charisse, still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Let me talk a little bit more about your thoughts about this new news coming out of Louisville and Breonna Taylor. I again, as Ava said before she left, this seems to be a slow turn of the wheels of justice, and it amazes me. Why this took so long.
Right. And so here, I think what's important to understand when we talk about police unions is the idea that police unions were only really started or really got the teeth that they have today once black folks started joining the force. So that's the thing that I think people forget when they think about the unions, is that the unions really didn't spring up until black folks started joining the force, and that then there was this insider kind of outsider game. There's a young man that I met here in Atlanta whose father was the first black man to serve on the Atlanta police force, and he told stories about how he was separated even in dressing and preparing for the day when he would go out to serve the public as a police officer, and how the union backed that decision right at the time. And so that's the thing that I think that we need to think about, is the structure of how do we get here, right? So because before you go and try to smash something apart, you first have to understand how you got to that point. And so that's what I think is extremely important for us to think about, is why did police unions rise up to begin with, and if we can use why they rose up to break them back down, we'll be successful. When it comes to knowing what's politically possible, I have a nonprofit called the Black Leadership Roundtable, and we just entered into an initiative with the city of San Antonio, who is coming up with suggestions for the police force. And what I find to be the case several times over is that people have a misnomer about the amount of money that the localities are actually have control over inside of these municipalities, right? That the unions in many ways are even steering the money, right? And that's the thing that I think people have this misnomer, that, oh, we're going to defund the police. Well, wait a minute. Who do you need to have that conversation with, and who has to be at the table? And police unions have to be at that table because they steer a lot of the money. And what I mean by that, as a native Californian, when I used to teach California politics, students were amazed to find out that the police unions were the second highest giver to political campaigns. I mean, they
yes.
were shocked. They
absolutely.
Were shocked they were just, I mean, Harold, they were just flabbergasted, right? Number one in the state of California was realtors, right? Realtors were number one, police unions were number two, and then teachers were number three, right? And so they were just shocked at the power that they're wielding in these spaces. And so when we talk about these things, or when we talk about the justice, and I agree with Sister Dr. Avis, that I don't think that we're going to see justice for her killing, but what I do hope that we get, that we understand, is that we need to get rid of, we need to remove resources from these police officers. One of the reasons that you can execute a no-knock warrant safely is because you've been militarized, because you have military-grade weapons that don't belong on the streets in the United States. Those belong on the battlefield. And so what you're telling me is that once you decide to militarize the police force, that it is that we're in a war zone, and it is okay for you to then wage war on me, right? Not just from a psychological standpoint, but from a physical weaponized standpoint. And to me, that is the thing that we have to take from her case, is how do we demilitarize while we defund?
Yeah, because we get into this new battle about semantics, defund versus reimagine. And I think that's going to be, you know, one of the things that moving forward, we're going to hear a lot more about when it comes to funding police departments. I think that's a good place to end this conversation. I want to thank you, Dr. Sharice Nelson, for talking to us. Also, Dr. Avis Jones-DeWeaver, who was also part of this great conversation. And I also want to remind you that coming up at 8:15, I'm going to talk to Rashawn McDonald about all kinds of great stuff. Branding and finding your best business life and ideas, even in the midst of a pandemic. You don't want to miss that on HUR at Home on all of our social media platforms. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, June 23rd. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.